Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. The Sandpiper Pipeline Project, building energy security, expanding access to North Dakota crude oil, creating construction jobs. Those are the words on the front page of a brochure from the Enbridge Energy Company about a proposed 610-mile pipeline that would take up to 225,000 barrels of crude oil a day from the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota across northern Minnesota to a terminal in Superior, Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg for Enbridge Energy. The need for the pipeline is obvious. 3,000 construction jobs, a way to turn American oil into the gas we put in our cars while securing our energy independence from hostile foreign countries. But it's not obvious to the White Earth Ojibwe tribe of northern Wisconsin, whose reservation is skirted by the pipeline route, which crosses close to sacred wild rice beds and the upper Mississippi watershed. And it's not obvious to James Botsford, a Wausau man who is worried about climate change and who is being sued by Enbridge Energy for refusing to allow the pipeline to cross his land in North Dakota. James Botsford is our guest today on Route 51, along with Ojibwe businessman Paul DeMain, a member of the Lakotere tribe, the CEO of Indian Country Communications, and a former candidate for state senate. Also in this program, we will hear in just a bit from Lorraine Little, the Senior Manager, U.S. Public Affairs, Liquids Operations and Projects for Enbridge Energy. You can join the conversation at 1-800-780-9742, or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. That number again is 1-800-780-9742. And if you're interested in the music we were just listening to in the introduction to the show, that's the guitar of Sean Hopper, who was a guest on this program just a couple of weeks ago. James Botsford, Paul DeMain, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting
us. Good morning.
We had originally tried to get Winona LaDuke of Northern Minnesota's White Earth Band of Ojibwe on this program. She's a former vice presidential candidate on the Green Party ticket with Ralph Nader. She has been an outspoken activist against the Sandpiper Pipeline Project, but she had a conflict, so we are very happy today that Paul DeMain is filling in with her. Paul, you've worked extensively with Winona LaDuke on environmental issues. Why is she and the White Earth Tribe fighting this pipeline project?
Well, it's not just the Sandpiper, it's the Clipper, it's expansion of the extraction of extreme minerals, the extreme oil extraction that's now going on with tar sands, some of the dirtiest oil being extracted out of Canada and sent south, some of the fracking that's going on, the pushing of chemicals and sand into the whole fracking operations out in the Dakotas and Montana. And so it's not just one particular line, and it's not just the White Earth Reservation. These oil lines cross both near or on the White Earth Reservation, Red Lake Reservation, Leech Lake, Fond du Lac, cross the Bad River Reservation, cross the Lakotere Reservation. So you have tribal communities in general that are concerned about this situation, especially in a situation where in many cases the state and public authorities, Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, and Enbridge itself in a lot of cases doesn't necessarily consult very well with the tribes.
You mentioned your own tribe, the Lakotere Reservation. Tell us about that pipeline.
Yes, I'm a resident of the Lakotere Reservation. I'm actually a member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin, but Lakotere has three pipelines that currently cross the southwestern edge of the reservation. Pipeline 61, the one that's being expanded up to be able to pump 3 to 4 times more oil than what it was built for. It was built for 400,000 gallons per day. It's being upgraded to do 1.2 million barrels per day based on the sludge that they're now pushing through the pipelines. So they're going to increase the pressure. Line 61 was forced to go outside of the reservation because the Lakotere tribe some 15 or 20 years ago said enough is enough. We don't want to be worried about the potential risk of oil spills, of which there's been some 800 on Enbridge lines just in the last 10 years. They forced that line outside of the reservation, and they continue to monitor the situation and be concerned about community safety and the potential damage to the ecological sensitive areas of northern Wisconsin and their treaty resources, which are harvested for food, not sport.
Well, when the certificate of need for this pipeline was approved in Minnesota, Winona LaDuke called it a declaration of war against her people. Wasn't that rhetoric a little over the top and extreme?
Well, it might be rhetoric, but I don't think it's over the top or extreme. When you're starting to deal with the potential damages to the environment that these projects entail, I mean, they had something like 843,444 gallons spill in the Kalamazoo River in 2010. It took 17 hours for them to turn the pipeline pressure off, and Enbridge has spent $1 billion trying to rehabilitate that particular river. That oil sinks, it doesn't float. It's a long cleanup, which had toxic chemicals, because you have to put these highly violative thinners into this tar sand and Balkans oil to thin it out in order to push it through it. It's the consistency of peanut butter. And so when they're pushing this through these pipelines, they have to thin it out. And so when a spill occurs, the immediate thing that neighbors in Kalamazoo realize is they were getting sick because of the vaporization of these thinners into the air that they were breathing. So it's long. It's the potential for damage. It's the potential to fires and explosions that you've seen. You saw people in Canada. 26 people were vaporized in a train line derailment a couple years ago with this kind of oil. You saw the Kalamazoo disaster. I think there's some concerns that say that this is at a level which means that if you don't listen to us, it is a declaration of war.
That pipeline only touches a far corner of the White Earth Reservation, but my understanding is that the present reservation is only a tenth of the size of what was originally promised to the Ojibwe people in the treaties signed in the 1800s. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. It does go through the northeast corner of the reservation, but it goes through very secluded areas and remote areas, which is a concern, because if there's a spill, a lot of times these spills aren't discovered, especially they don't call these small spills, they call them leaks, and they can leak for days before they're discovered on the lines. It's within the Mississippi headwaters. It's within the 1855 treaty territory. That territory is very, very heavy in natural resources and wild rice, which many of those reservations populations rely upon at White Earth and Leech Lake. It's at the headwaters of the Mississippi River, and so It doesn't make any difference what size the White Earth Reservation is. When it impacts treaty resources or the potential ability to eat them, harvest them, to produce commerce, you're talking about impacting the daily lives of indigenous people.
Talk about the significance, Paul DeMaine, of the wild rice beds, and significance not just in terms of sustenance and commerce, but also as a spiritual resource for the Ojibwe people.
Well, the Ojibwe people were drawn from the East Coast after a series of dreams and visions back to the Great Lakes region, and in those visions and in speaking to the spirit, they were told that they would return to the place where food grew on water. And so in the creation stories and the traditional stories of the Ojibwe people, one of the key reasons that they came back from the East Coast and relocated in the Great Lakes was to be by that food which would feed them. And so just like with the wolf and the stories of him walking the same fate as indigenous people, rice was put on the table as the primary thing that the Creator was gifting to Anishinaabe people to survive. So deep in these ceremonies and medicine lodge, rice is spoken about as a very sacred item that will sustain our people. So it is considered very sacred.
If you just joined us, you're listening to Paul DeMaine, the CEO of Indian Country Communications. We're talking about the proposed Sandpiper line, the pipeline by Enbridge Energy. We'll be joined a little bit later in this program by Lorraine Little, who is a senior manager for U.S. Public Affairs for Enbridge Energy. But let's turn now to James Botsford. James, you live in Wausau. You are being sued by Enbridge Energy. Where does that court case stand now against you?
Well, it started about 2.5 years ago when Enbridge called us at dinner hour, my wife and I, and said, greetings, we have great news. Your land has been selected for our pipeline proposed route. This is farmland that my wife and I own in North Dakota, where I'm originally from. It's been in my family for many decades. When my parents passed away, it came to us, and we are trying to be good custodians of it and give it to our children. And Enbridge eventually, first they sent me a letter on my birthday saying they were taking us to court to get a restraining order against us because we declined to give them permission to go across our land. Then the judge gave them the restraining order. I don't know why. I mean, we're over here in Wisconsin, retired, but we got a restraining order against us so they could go across our land to survey a route. Then they got that done and dismissed the restraining order, and then they kept calling 15 different times, mostly at dinner hour, offering more money each time if we would let them build this pipeline.
How much were they offering you?
Oh, it started out at $15,000, then it went to $25,000, $35,000, $38,000, and $51,000 was the highest they offered us. This is to cross a quarter section of North Dakota farmland.
$51,000?
Yeah.
You know, there aren't a lot of people who would reject that money for a project that most people feel would be a done deal anyway.
Well, you know, my wife and I, we're not zealots. We drive cars and drive a little yard tractor and so forth. But we're very concerned about climate change. We're grandparents, and even if we weren't, we would still be concerned. And so when Enbridge comes knocking at your door and says, we would like you to contribute to the further increase of fossil fuels generating carbon in the atmosphere, and we'll pay you to participate in putting more carbon in the atmosphere with us, that's when you have to take a stand. And so we just felt we didn't want that bad karma. We did not want to be participating in that.
Is this a David and Goliath story?
Actually, it's Goliath v. David because they sued us.
All right. I get that you're concerned about climate change. But like you said, you drive a car. You put gasoline in that car. The gas has to come from someplace. It comes from the oil, so the oil has to get to the refineries to produce the gas that you, James Botsford, put in your car.
Well, the fossil fuel era has been a good run. We benefited greatly as a nation and me personally. But all of the science indicates we have to get smarter. We have to turn a corner. Many other countries are now over 50% renewable energy. The entrepreneurial and ingenuity spirit of America has always led the world in finding new solutions and creative ways to solve problems. Here, we are under the onus of big oil to keep going with the status quo, to suck the last drops of fossil fuel out of the earth with like what Paul called extreme extraction. And we need to smarten up, or we're going to be in too deep a hole to leave a healthy world for the next generations.
Are you working actively with the tribes that are also fighting this project?
Well, in a sense, as Paul mentioned, you know, the Minnesota tribes in particular are deeply concerned, and there's a lot of support for this, for questioning what Enbridge is doing in Minnesota. There's the Friends of the Headwaters Foundation, every Indian tribe in the state, a coalition of family farmers, the climate change groups like 350.org, they are all questioning whether this is a smart idea. In North Dakota, however, it's really lonely fighting this. Of all about 800 landowners that they had to cross to put this pipeline in, my wife and I are the only ones who said no. Everybody else took the money.
Now, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is what I read, is that you're an attorney who has worked with Native American groups before?
Yeah, my whole career of 30 years was Indian rights law.
Paul DeMaine, what do you think of James Botsford's story?
Well, I think it's a growing awareness of the impacts that individuals and groups of people have on the potential philosophy about where we ought to be going with our energy policy. James is right in pointing out that there are several countries, in fact, there are some that have exceeded 50% utilization of non-renewables. In other words, they're using wind and solar. And it seems to me that the United States, people continually say about how we're supposed to be a leader in everything, and yet we can't seem to get our mindset out of this idea that we need to extract the last of the oils, no matter what situation it is. The days of drilling into a pool of oil and having it coming out the way it used to is pretty much over. And so these extreme extraction activities going on that are destroying the north woods in the regions of Cree territory in the north, only to be shipped down across here. I mean, you look at this during September. Enbridge was testing one of its lines in Minnesota with water, and line 2B leaked 700 barrels of this dyed water. When you talk to some of the people who have constructed some of these pipelines, they're saying that these pipelines aren't made to sustain what Enbridge is trying to do with them. And so now that they're trying to construct a new one, the question is this route a reasonable route? Now, James and other people, Winona, myself, would prefer that we not have any new pipelines, that we begin to utilize renewable energies rather than fracking or tar sands as our sources of energy. So we pretty much just oppose the idea that we ought to be allowing any of this. And forced industry, like the Rockefeller family recently said, they're not going to be investing in these kinds of projects. And we even question the need to do these projects in the face of the dropping oil values. But what also concerns
Paul, let me interrupt you.
Corporations can come along and condemn James Botsford's land. They're provided with eminent domain. They're provided with waivers on liability issues, like in this last budget, which had nothing to do with the budget, in which policy was changed to give these big, large corporations just about anything that they want to do over the citizens of the state of Wisconsin, Minnesota, or North Dakota.
Paul DeMaine, I have to interrupt you just for a second here. We need to take a phone call. Ray from Rhinelander, you're on Route 51 with Paul DeMaine and James Botsford.
Hi, Paul. Hi, James. I really respect all of you for what you're doing. And my name is Ray Quicksilver. I've been involved with a lot of this stuff most of my life. I'm in my 60s. Started off with Al Geddix over at the Crandon Mine back in the 70s. Later on with Walter Prisette, bless his soul. Anyways, we had a mining symposium at Nicolet College. And bear with me, I'm going to get to a really important point here. Back in the 80s, we invited all kinds of tribes from all over the United States, Mexico, South America. We only had a few from the southern regions to tell their stories on how they were affected with their indigenous ways of life, with these mining companies just coming in, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that was very good because the important emphasis on that was, and I want to make this very clear. In fact, I was talking to Bobby Bullitt about this the other day. All tribes have to get together. All peoples have to get together now. These corporations are so organized, and they work on 40-year plans. They already got two or three plans ahead of us. There is some we are fragmented somewhat, only in the sense that we need to get organized. We need to have symposiums like this. We need to have informational things. And yes, if it weren't for the tribes, the indigenous people in this state, this crap would have went through.
Ray, we got it. I've got to give Paul DeMaine a chance to respond because we've got a lot to pack into this program. Thanks so much for your phone call. And Ray mentioned Bobby Bullitt. He is a Native American musician. Paul DeMaine?
Yeah, well, he mentioned a couple things about how this is an important issue. And I mean, at Lacouderay here on November 7th, there's a gathering of people at a women's and water gathering that'll be taking place. The subject will be pipeline safety and pipelines. coming up on March 12th of next year. The Lac-Couturier Tribe and several other organizations are sponsors of a public hearing in which we're going to be asking people to come in. The last public hearing we had, group meeting we had here at Lac-Couturier, we had township and county officials were there, fire responders who were very concerned about the fact that our communities are not ready for the kinds of spills and potential fires that could come along with this. And in fact, they understand very well. They were told that if there was some kind of a leak or fire, that they should pretty much wait for Enbridge response from Superior, Wisconsin, which is some 90 miles away. So you begin looking at these time elements, and you know that local fire departments are not capable of responding fully to these kinds of industrial accidents. And that brings to the point, you know, really these pipelines are extension of an industrial site into rural communities. And as I indicated a little bit earlier, the Enbridge has been coaxing this along for many, many years, in fact, denying the fact that there was a twin to Pipeline 61 being planned. They call it an evaluation until they actually get the pipelines on site and start putting them in. But there is a whole idea that there ought to be a twin to Pipeline 61, which very few people know about it because Enbridge has continually denied that they ever had any future plans. So what they say at stockholders' meetings is, we're evaluating the possibility, despite they have the maps, they've got the choreographs, they've got the easements that are going in and everything else they need way in front of the timeline, which is what happened in Minnesota.
Paul DeMaine, I've got to interrupt you. We have to take a break. Our guests are Paul DeMaine of the Lac-Couturier Tribe, CEO of Indian Country Communications, a former candidate for state senate. Also, James Botsford of Wausau, who is being sued by Enbridge Energy for refusing to allow the pipeline to cross his land. I'm Glenn Moberg. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll hear an extended interview with Lorraine Little, the Senior Manager, U.S. Public Affairs, Liquids Operations and Projects for Enbridge Energy on Route 51 on the Ideas Network.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Menominee Street Dental, Becca Cates, and Birch Creek Music Performance Center. You, too, can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Northwind Renewable Energy, Stevens Point, with a focus on renewable energy system design and installation, including solar, wood, and deep energy retrofits to existing buildings. NorthwindRE.com.
Our guest today on Route 51, Paul DeMaine of the Lac-Couturier Tribe, CEO of Indian Country Communications, James Botsford of Wausau, who's being sued by Enbridge Energy for refusing to allow a pipeline to cross his land in North Dakota. And we are going to get back with both of them live on the air in just a bit. But first, for the other side of this story, here's an extended interview that I conducted yesterday with Lorraine Little. She's the Senior Manager, U.S. Public Affairs, Liquids Operations and Projects for Enbridge Energy. My first question to her, why do you believe the Sandpiper Pipeline Project is needed?
Pipelines are the safest and most efficient way to transport large volumes of crude oil over long distances, and that's been a statistic that has been put out there by PHMSA, the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. Currently, I think the Bakken region produces about 1 million barrels per day of crude oil, and they just simply don't have that pipeline capacity to match that production. And so, you know, what you see is about maybe 400,000 or so barrels that are able to move out by pipeline, and so the rest is going out by train. And so the Sandpiper pipeline, the 225,000 barrels that it will be able to move out of the North Dakota area would be equivalent to about 1,700 rail cars a day.
1,700 rail cars a day. How important is this pipeline to the Midwest economy in terms of short-term construction jobs?
Well, the Sandpiper pipeline, once it receives all of the necessary regulatory approvals, it will need about 3,000 workers to construct the project, and that would be, if you can imagine building a 600-mile-long pipeline, is a very intensive process, and so it takes a lot of people power in order to make that happen. So we're looking at about 3,000 workers.
And long-term, what would that mean to the Midwest economy, and how vital do you think it is to meeting America's energy needs?
Well, the project itself is about a $2.6 billion private investment in energy infrastructure. So certainly that in and of itself has an impact on regional economies, because not only are you talking about, you know, the jobs that go along or that are necessary in order to build that kind of infrastructure, but you also see the kind of offset spending or offshoot spending take place in communities along the construction route, where you see, you know, an uptick in purchases at gas stations or hotels or restaurant spending, because those workers need a place to stay and fuel their vehicles, and in turn also the project would be, you know, purchasing supplies and those kinds of things as well. But then if you kind of pull back and you look at the impact on the greater economy or what this does for in terms of energy independence, really what you're taking a look at is the fact that, you know, by being able to supply North American refineries with North American production, you are offsetting supplies from foreign imports or unfriendly countries countries that we typically think of as being unfriendly to U.S. interests. And the more we're able to provide access to those North American refineries to that safe and reliable crude oil, the more that we don't have to rely on imports from unfriendly nations.
Well, critics say that this oil is simply going to be shipped out into the global market, and then they point out that you're not even an American firm, you're Canadian. So they say the benefit to our domestic energy supplies and our American economy will be minimal. How do you respond to those arguments? I'm sure you've heard them before.
Well, Enbridge actually has a partner on this project, which is, very much an American company. And they, the reason that they're a partner in this project is that they would like to serve their Midwestern refinery with this North Dakota crude oil production. And so crude oil that would be shipped on the Sandpiper pipeline is spoken for by North American refineries. So it's very much a project that will be serving either Midwestern refineries or Eastern refineries, but it will be staying in North America.
Last month, the Minnesota Court of Appeals ruled that the pipeline couldn't go forward without a complete environmental impact statement. Opponents of the pipeline hailed the ruling as a big victory. Was it indeed a victory for them, and how much of a setback was it for you?
Well, I'd like to point out that there is tremendous support for the Sandpiper Pipeline Project, that originally when the Public Utilities Commission granted Certificate of Need for the project back in June, that it was a unanimous granting of need based on the merits of the case. So really what happened with the Court of Appeals ruling is they took a look at the way that the Public Utilities Commission had handled the case, meaning that typically what they would do is they would carry the docket forward, where you'd have routing permit and certificate of need going together side by side, where you'd have, you know, the environmental review and those kinds of things taking place at the same time that you would be evaluating certificate of need. And during the process, opposition groups came in and made some efforts to bifurcate the process, and so the Public Utilities Commission went along with that.
Yeah, Lorraine, I read the court case and the decision, and it indicated that it was premature to grant that certificate of need before the environmental impact had been studied.
Well, so because the process got bifurcated, the environmental review was always going to be part of the process. It's just that they hadn't quite, they hadn't gotten there yet because they bifurcated their process. But so really what's taking place right now is that the PUC in early October had met, and they chose to stay the certificate of need, meaning they basically froze it after the August order. What's taking place right now is that there's a comment period where parties can write in and say, you know, what their thoughts are in terms of restarting the process. I think once the PUC gathers all of those comments, then they'll be able to decide how they'd like to move forward with both.
The White Earth and Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe object to the pipeline going anywhere near their wild rice beds in the headwaters of the Mississippi. They say that the lands and the rice are sacred to them. Why not route the pipeline somewhere else?
Well, the significance of wild rice to the people living near our pipelines, definitely cannot be understated. And like all of the natural and environmental resources that are located along any of our pipeline routes or proposed pipeline routes, we work hard to protect them during the planning, construction, and operation of our pipelines. And we do understand that it's a sustaining resource for many along the route, and we'll definitely treat it as such. You know, we also welcome the opportunity to dialogue with all of the stakeholders along our route, and we've, in fact, reached out to all of the tribes that have raised their hands and indicated an interest in this project. You know, we'll continue to seek ways to sit down and talk with them.
Well, the Ojibwe view the entire region as part of their lands. The current reservation at White Earth is only 10% of what was originally promised to them in the treaties. And the Ojibwe continue to have the right to access the wild rice beds throughout the region. So to them, this pipeline project affects not just their current reservation, but an area 10 times as large that they think should still be part of that reservation. And, you know, the language has been pretty heated. Winona LaDuke of the White Earth Band said when the Certificate of Need was initially granted by the Minnesota Public Utility Commission, that the action was, in her words, a declaration of war against her people. How do you react to that?
Well, Enbridge has operated six pipelines across two Indian reservations, Leech Lake and Fond du Lac Reservation, for more than 65 years. And, you know, we've done so in cooperation with Leech Lake and Fond du Lac. We've, you know, worked with them on their concerns for their natural resources, and certainly we're prepared to do the same with White Earth, and we've in fact sat down with White Earth Tribal Government and discussed their concerns about wild rice in the area next to the reservation, and we've looked at ways to reroute the pipeline to mitigate their concerns. Their concerns about the wild rice in those particular areas, and you know, we'd like to continue to have those discussions with them.
Well, this is how she describes the pipeline. She says it's worse than Keystone, and that if you get your way, you, quote, could soon be transporting nearly 4 million barrels of oil every day, more than four times the amount piped by the proposed Keystone pipeline across the ecologically sensitive Minnesota North Woods. That's a direct quote from her. Is that accurate?
You know, I'd have to take a look at what the barrels, right now, we're transporting about 2 million barrels per day of oil with the existing infrastructure that we have across the state of Minnesota. If Sandpiper is in fact approved, we'd be looking at adding about 225,000 barrels to that. We also have another project, Line 3 Replacement, that would be replacing an existing pipeline and restoring it back to its original capabilities. So to say 4 million barrels, I think by my math, is definitely overstated. You know, I think the bottom line, though, is that pipelines are the safest way to transport crude oil, and that this crude oil, you know, we're bringing in crude oil from Canada and from North Dakota, and we're serving markets in North America, and this energy serves all of us, that we all rely on safe and reliable energy, and what's the best way to, you know, for all of us to do that is to have a safe and reliable energy transportation system.
Well, Winona LaDuke also says that you've got a pretty bad record with oil spills. She points to the 2010 spill of, her language is 20,000 barrels into the Kalamazoo River, but 840,000 gallons, according to the Star Tribune. I'm not sure how those, you know, figures correlate. But she says, despite your safety systems, the spill went on for 17 hours. And then she does some math. She says, if the Sandpiper line broke, Bakken crude would spill out at a rate of 260 barrels a minute. It would be 60 hours before you could deliver equipment to the area. More than 900,000 barrels would gush out. Is that projection realistic? And if it is or if it isn't, how can you assure them that the pipeline will be safe when you just had this spill into the Kalamazoo River in Michigan?
Well, you know, the incident in Michigan was more than 5 years ago. And that was definitely one of the darkest times in our company's history. And I'll say that we've done everything possible to not have that happen again. And that is our focus, that, you know, safety is our top priority, and we've implemented a number of different systems from, you know, changing the way that we handle our control center and the way our control center operators operate our pipelines, and if they see, you know, something taking place where they have concerns, you know, how they shut down the system and then call out the local personnel to come and take a look at what's going on with that system. So it's things like that, to investing more than $4 billion into maintenance of our system, to, you know, more than $25 million into emergency response training and equipment. So, you know, to say things like that and to speculate like that is just a fear tactic. You know, we do everything that we can to operate our system as safe as possible. In Minnesota alone, we have, you know, more than 400 people that live and work across our system. So, you know, we live and work here too, and it's in our best interest, just like everybody else's, to protect the natural resources that we love too.
Hillary Clinton has now come out against the Keystone XL. Are you worried that there's a change in political climate in America that threatens your ability to open the pipelines that you need to get the oil to the refineries?
You know, I think in general there's it's more difficult to build energy infrastructure, and I say that because I think there's just there's a lot more scrutiny at all different types of levels, you know, whether it's the top government levels to the local community level. Everybody has a heightened awareness of energy infrastructure and, you know, in particular pipelines, and people have more questions. And I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing. Having people interested in what we do and asking questions about what we do, I think that that's okay. And I think that we as a company have really, our goal is really to get out and talk to people and, you know, explain what we do. And I think ultimately, you know, it's important for people to understand that our pipeline system provides the crude oil to the local refineries, whether it's Minnesota or Wisconsin or Illinois, that ultimately turns into a gallon of gas that goes into their vehicle that gets them to work or to school or home every day.
One of the guests on our program is James Botsford, who's, well, as I understand it, you're suing him because of his refusal to allow the pipeline across his land in North Dakota. He says the land has been in his family for generations. He's opposed to the project in part because of his concern about climate change. Why don't you just reroute the pipeline around his land?
Well, we've, you know, as with all of the, you know, thousands of landowners on the Sandpiper Project, we've worked hard with Mr. Botsford to try to come to an amicable resolution, and we've done that with the vast majority of the landowners on these projects. And so, you know, unfortunately, we weren't able to come to an agreement with him, and so we did have to go to court, and we were granted an easement to be able to cross his property. But, you know, in general, we are able to sit down and work with the landowners that we cross, and that is the goal, to come to an amicable resolution.
But in his case, again, why not just reroute the pipeline around his land?
Well, you know, certainly if everybody who had a concern, you know, we did that, you'd have a pipeline that was an interesting shape.
We're used to eminent domain being used for public utilities, but you're not a public utility, are you? You're a private company from Canada with an American partner that will make money off of the Sandpiper line. Is this an appropriate use for eminent domain?
Well, we went through the regulatory process in North Dakota. It was through the North Dakota Public Service Commission, and we were granted a certificate of need back in June, I think, of 2014. And so with that, you know, by going through the North Dakota regulatory process and by the North Dakota Public Service Commission deeming this a project that serves the public interest of North Dakotans, we were awarded the right of eminent domain. And so so with that comes the authority to condemn him when we have to. But, you know, again, I'll say he was the minority, and that we were able to come to resolution with the vast majority of people along the route.
What is Enbridge Energy's stance on climate change? Do you believe that it's happening? Do you believe that it's man-made?
We recognize that climate change is a very critical issue, and Well, Enbridge is an energy transportation company, so in other words, we don't produce the fossil fuels that we transport. We are committed to advancing climate solutions within our company and within our industry, and then also at a broader, more collaborative level with our customers and other partners and stakeholders. And so, you know, we focus on the reliable operations of our pipelines, but and in doing so, we take a look at, you know, what can we do as a company to minimize our effect on climate change. And so, you know, we've worked hard to reduce greenhouse gas emissions on our existing operations. We also design, you know, our new infrastructure so that it maximizes energy efficiency. But I think beyond Enbridge, though, that the solution is bigger than we are. And so it really is going to require, you know, solution to climate change really requires something that is a public policy approach that is a collaboration between government and industry, communities and environmental organizations, and so it's a partnership approach that's bigger than we are.
What can you do, Lorraine Little, to ensure your critics that the pipeline will be safe, that it will be a net benefit for jobs in the Midwest, and that it's important for America's energy security?
Well, we at Enbridge, we know that life takes energy, and that every day people in Wisconsin or Minnesota or across North America count on the more than 2 million barrels of oil a day that we transport in our pipelines. We take that responsibility incredibly seriously, and the safe and reliable delivery of energy is a part of who we are. That's our number one priority. And so, you know, that's really why our focus is investing heavily in tools and technologies and training in order to make sure that our pipeline systems are operating efficiently and safely, and that we're, you know, providing our energy transportation services in the most efficient manner possible.
Lorraine Little, thanks so much for agreeing to be part of this program. That's Lorraine Little, the Senior Manager, U.S. Public Affairs for Enbridge Energy, in an interview we conducted yesterday. I'm Glenn Moberg. When we come back on Route 51, we will get reaction to her comments from James Botsford of Wausau, who is being sued by Enbridge Energy, and also Paul DeMaine, CEO of Indian Country Communications.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Florentine Opera of Milwaukee, La Lingerie, and Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts, proud sponsors of WPR programs. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-Law.com.
We're back on Route 51 with Paul DeMaine of the Lacouture Tribe. He is also the CEO of Indian Country Communications and a former candidate for state senate. Our other guest, James Botsford of Wausau, who is being sued by Enbridge Energy for refusing to allow the pipeline project to cross his land in North Dakota. I'm Glenn Moberg. We just heard from Lorraine Little, an extended interview with her. She is the Senior Manager for U.S. Public Affairs for Enbridge Energy, and I want your reactions. We're going to start with James Botsford. James?
Thank you. You know, Ms. Little, the Enbridge spokesperson, said that their goal is to get out and talk to people. What she failed to say is that if the people don't then agree with them, they'll sue them. And that's what they did to my wife and I. And when we got to court, we tried to raise the issue of climate change. Enbridge argued, successfully, I'm sorry to say, that it was none of our business. It's none of Enbridge's business, and it's none of the court's business.
What do you make for the different tone that we heard here this morning?
Well, it's nuancing. It's parsing out words, you know. They're very heavy-handed. They're the largest oil pipeline corporation in the world. After the 15th call to my house, they finally had some guy who said he was one of the senior guys on this project call, and it, just out of exasperation, I said, "Look, I'm never going to agree to this. Why don't you just go around us?" Same question you asked her. To which he replied, "Mr. Botsford, you don't understand. We're Enbridge. We don't go around anything. We go through it." And it was shortly after that they sued us.
Where does that court case stand right now, James Botsford?
Well, as I said, the climate change issue, Enbridge says, is none of the court's business. So the issue we're stuck with in court is eminent domain. And they want to take our land, a private foreign corporation, take our land against our wishes for their corporate purposes. They got a judge to agree, gave them summary judgment saying that, yeah, well, right or wrong, the North Dakota Public Service Commission did grant them, to grant Enbridge, this governmental power to condemn private property. And so we are waiting for the final judgment to be issued by the court, and then we will be appealing to the North Dakota Supreme Court.
Paul DeMaine, your reaction to the comments from Lorraine Little?
Well, you know, Lorraine is smooth. She's paid a lot to be able to fit those words in there, safe and reliable on a regular basis, and the jobs, because we can create alternative jobs in renewable energy. And the question is whether or not this energy is safe, whether the transportation of it's safe, and what seems to be the rush to try to get all this oil down the pipeline. I mean, Glenn, you have to, I think, look at the pipeline schematic to see what's going on throughout this country, whether or not this Enbridge project, Sandpiper, and everything, the upgrades that are going on, is going around the need for XL Keystone, which is a shortcut from Canada to Freeport, Texas. And the long-term implications of this. It's kind of like a mining company saying holding ponds are safe and sound because we engineer them so well, but then you read a week later that there's a breach somewhere which destroys the environment. So it's not that our fears are unfounded. But when you get into a situation where there is no environmental impact statement on the Sandpiper, which the federal courts have now said the Public Utilities Commission in Minnesota has to go back and order this entire environmental impact statement. There was no environmental impact statement on the upgrade of 61 through Wisconsin. And as James says, this is Enbridge. They don't go around anybody. They go through. You find out that state government here in Wisconsin is tweaking the eminent domain laws in budget bills rather than having public hearings. It's because their lobbyists are out there saying, hey, we need this to get this thing through. That's going outside of the citizens of the state of Wisconsin and favoring this foreign corporations over local impact, local zoning, and local review.
I want to squeeze in one more phone call very quickly here. Carl in Madison, you've been very patient. Carl, you're on Route 51, and unfortunately I have to ask you to make your comments brief.
Well, Mr. Moberg, you are fantastic. This program is fantastic. I don't get to hear it down where I am in Wisconsin, southern section, but this is a critical issue. While we've been looking west toward the Keystone Line, they have run a river of oil through this aquifer of the state. And Mr. DeMaine, your work is outstanding on this. We're going to be coming up to the Lac-Couturier Reservation to talk about what we know about tar sands and other lines through Wisconsin on November 7th. And I just have to say, the Lac-Couturier are the only place where there is a kink in that armor, where 61 and Line 13 do go around the corner of the Lac-Couturier Reservation, because the Lac-Couturier tribe said, you're not coming through again like you did with 6A and 14. So it can be done. This is not a hopeless cause. This is people getting organized, getting educated, listening to the facts instead of being schmoozed about how safe pipelines are. It's not the pipeline, it's the product. It's unsafe to transport by any means.
All right, Carl.
So I
Carl,
applaud your program. Thank you.
Thank you. We got it. Paul DeMaine, we're down to our last 45 seconds or so here. Your reaction to that and any final words you've got?
I think 2 years ago, if you would ask the question about pipeline safety, there would have been hardly anyone in the community listening. I think tenfold by come next spring, we're going to have people who are looking at this, and that's the kind of citizens review it needs. So, Glenn, thanks for having me on. I appreciate the questions you did ask of Enbridge. They were good. Keep moving on Line 51. Not Line 51, Route 51.
All right. Thank you so much, Paul DeMaine. James Botsford, what happens if all those courts rule against you? What then?
Well, we're going to fight it as long as we can. I told them I'm not going to give you anything. You're going to have to take it from me. And on this safety issue, if I could make one more point, I contacted four different large insurance companies to ask them if they would give us insurance against a leak or spill by Enbridge on a pipeline across our property. None of them would do it.
James Botsford, Paul DeMaine, thank you so much for being with us. We want to thank today's guests, James Botsford of Wausau, Paul DeMaine of the Lac-Couturier Tribe, CEO of Indian Country Communications in Hayward, and a former candidate for state senate, and Lorraine Little, senior manager, U.S. Public Affairs for Enbridge Energy. You can find out more about James Botsford's legal fight with Enbridge Energy at GoFundMe.com. You can find out more about Paul DeMaine and his media operation at IndianCountryNews.com. And you can find out more about Enbridge Energy and the Sandpiper Pipeline at Enbridge.com/Sandpiper Project. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Dean Kallenbach, and our on-air producer, Lori Frazier. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Peter Phippen, Sean Hopper, and the Shantays. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. And until next week, we're heading out of town.